Welcome back to the show. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Dave Schrader filling in for George Norrie. And if you like the strange and the supernatural, make sure you check out my show Monday through Friday at darknessradio.com, where we are constantly exploring the strange and the supernatural. Our guests this evening, two actual eyewitnesses on the site seeing this case unfold, Richard Gross, the son of Morris Gross, the lead investigator of the Enfield poltergeist case, Roz Morris, one of the journalists covering this case. We heard some really chilling audio, and I know during the break, Richard, I was getting a lot of people asking me to replay that segment where this voice, now, mind you, folks, this is coming from an 11-year-old girl. You just heard Richard kind of reproduce the voice as a grown adult man. But this voice is coming from the area of an 11-year-old girl. And you would ask if it could tell you anything about what it remembered before it died or what led up to it. And this voice came out. We're going to play this one more time, and then I'd like to talk to you about that for a few seconds. All right, Nathan, go ahead and play that.
Just before you died and just after you died.
Days before I died, my day, I went blind. Then I had an hemorrhage and I fell asleep and I died in a chair in a corner downstairs.
So this voice says that days before he died, he had a hemorrhage, he went blind, then fell asleep in the chair downstairs and passed away in that chair. Being investigators and looking into this, how quickly was that claim substantiated?
Well, it took a little while, but what actually happened was there was a radio program, a phone-in, and my father was on that program, and the tape was played. And it said, in order, I went blind, I had a hemorrhage, I fell asleep and died in the chair in the corner. By the way, my father, when he heard this, immediately said to Janet, what does hemorrhage mean? And, of course, she hadn't got a clue. But that's aside. This chap phoned in and said, yes, I really was interested to listen to that because that was my father. And so everyone was stunned. And it transpired that, yes, this was the son of the man who lived in the house. And he confirmed that he went blind and that he did have a hemorrhage and he did die in a chair downstairs in the living room. And he actually was buried about half a mile down the road from the house.
Did the son recognize the voice? Did the son recognize the voice or just the facts of what she was explaining?
He recognized the circumstance. I can't say whether he actually said that was the voice of my late father, because I suspect it wasn't. It was no one speaks like that. But the circumstance that he was talking to was those of his late father.
Roz, when you go from hearing knockings on the wall and things moving around in rooms that you're not there for, and all of a sudden there are voices or a voice kind of emanating out of nowhere but everywhere, what was that experience like?
Well, some people said to me, did you think that the voice could have been a pre-recorded in some way, which was a bit, wouldn't have been possible because it went on for so long, but also it didn't sound like a recording. It just sounded like this very strange, unusual voice. And I was interested to find that actually these sort of voices are part of the events that can happen when poltergeists happen. And of course, we haven't talked about, I expect you talk about this a lot on your show, but I mean, poltergeist means noisy spirit in German. And it's a phenomenon that's been reported for hundreds of years. And I, of course, approached all this in a journalistic fashion. And I researched, I talked to experts, scientists who went to the house and so on and got their views and so on, and I did interviews with people. And I'm remembering this is 40 years ago.
Right.
There's no internet. I had to get a book out of the library about poltergeists. There was sort of one book on poltergeists at that point, The Poltergeist by William Roll. And I got that book out and read about it, and I was amazed to find that all the things that were happening at Enfield had been reported at times over the centuries. So that was another reason why I followed the whole thing up and did a radio documentary about it, because it did seem to be part of something that does happen. We don't know why it happens. I have no idea. I'm still baffled by the whole thing. I don't know why it happened. But as a journalist, I took the same approach as I would to any news story. I researched and I looked into things and I interviewed people. And the voice just seemed to be there in the room. Janet said afterwards that if she felt as though the voice was kind of behind her, but she couldn't offer any explanation for it either.
Was it, I mean, to hear the recording of it, it's quite chilling. Was it hard to kind of hold your composure hearing this voice, looking at this girl, not seeing it come out of her or her sister?
Well, I was just concentrating on getting the recording, of course, as a radio reporter. This is just amazing to be able to record this. I think you've got to remember also, we were using, I was using, and so were Guy Playfair and Maurice Gross, we were all using reel-to-reel tape recorders. So it's really back in the Stone Age, all this sort of stuff. So we had to make sure we had enough tape. We had to make sure that the tape recorders were working, the batteries were okay and everything. So there was a lot to concentrate on, as well as actually listening to them. But I just found the whole thing very disturbing. I mean, one thing that all this did convince me was that, Guy Playfair was already an expert on mediums and poltergeists and so on. Morris became an expert on poltergeist. I made a vow I'm never going to go near this sort of stuff ever again. And I didn't.
All right, we need to take a quick break. We'll come back. And, you know, according to a lot of the accounts, Guy Lyon Playfair's position was to be there to kind of rein your father in and keep an eye on him and his investigative techniques and see if this was truly a legitimate case. And most accounts paint him as a huge skeptic to all of this. I want to see what the fact and fiction is on that when we return. We'll do that next on Coast to Coast AM. We're back on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Gross's father, Morris Gross, was the lead investigator on this case, was joined by Guy Lyon Playfair, also from the same society. Was Guy sent to kind of rein your father in and keep an eye on him for the society's
not at all.
Reputation. Okay.
Not at all. They were a team. What actually happened was that my father first went along because he had been badgering the secretary of the society for a field investigation. And then, one of life's great coincidences, this amazing, vastly important case came along, was handed to him, and he shot straight off. And when he arrived, he realized there was something going on, and he made a personal decision to devote however long it took to investigate it. It was precisely what he was looking for. And for the first 2 weeks, he battled on his own. And of course, he had no experience at that time. He simply had his common sense, his business acumen, which enabled him to evaluate situations and measure their veracity. But it was taking its toll as more and more happened. It was becoming more and more complicated. And he went back to the society on a number of occasions and said to them, look, you know, something's definitely going on at Enfield. Does someone not want to come and co-investigate or help out? And he was amazed how no one seemed to be particularly interested. Indeed, some of the leading scientists simply seemed to cocoon themselves in their work and not be interested in what actually might be happening out there. Anyway, Guy...
I was just going to say that the Society for Psychical Research, the SPR, had been contacted by the Mirror initially, and that's how your father came to be there.
That's right.
And then Guy Playfair heard about the case, but also he had just finished a book about mediums, and he'd been living in Brazil, and he'd written various books. He was already becoming an expert on the paranormal, and he didn't really want to go. He wanted to go on holiday, but he heard about the Enfield case. But then he heard my program on the Sunday, and he thought, I'd better go, and he went to the house the next day, and that's how he came to be there with your father, and how he came to write his book, which This House is Haunted, which was published in 1980.
How did people receive your program when you were talking about this? Was there a lot of skepticism and rolling of the eyes, tongue in the cheek, or was it pretty impactful to the listening audience?
My program?
Right.
Well, the this is a topic. The Enfield poltergeist is something I've been talking about it a lot recently, because we've had this program on the BBC where we look back for over 40 years, and Richard and I were both on that program, as you mentioned at the beginning. But actually, I haven't spent my life talking about this, because it is one of those things where people either look at you as though you're a complete idiot and don't want to talk to you at all, or you're still talking to them half an hour later, because everybody wants to tell you about their own family's experience and their own things that have happened, where they got a message from their mother after she died, or their aunt came to them, or that sort of thing. So it's one of those things where you don't talk about the Enfield poltergeist unless you want to talk about it.
Well, I meant, you said that Guy heard your presentation about it, and that's what made him decide to go. And I was just wondering, at that time when you were doing that presentation, you were doing that radio program about it, how did the audience respond during that time?
Well, of course, we don't know how the audience responded, because there's no internet and there's no way of knowing. You know, in those days, you just broadcast things, and occasionally the people rang up and the BBC logged calls. I don't know whether they had any calls about it. I don't know. But, I mean, it was a completely different world. As I said, I had to get a library book to find things out. It was reel-to-reel tape recorders. You didn't know what the audience thought about things. But I can tell you that my documentary, first of all, was put out on Boxing Day at 11:30. That's the 26th of December in the UK in 1978. It's 11:30 at night. So I don't think the BBC had massive confidence in it as an audience puller. However, they did repeat it during the daytime a couple of months later, and it was repeated twice on the BBC World Service, so it clearly did generate interest. But I think the interesting thing about all this is that Guy's book came out, there were various films, Hollywood took it up with the Poltergeist films, there was the Amityville Horror, there's a number of films that have similar themes, and then there was a certain amount of interest in this, there always is, but it really took off in 2005 when the internet was invented, and suddenly people could go on the web and form groups and find stuff about the paranormal and show their interest, and that's why we know now that there is a lot of interest.
So if I could just chip in here, because I think we started the conversation off by asking what the dynamic between my father and Guy was, and I did want to come back to that, because I think it's an important point.
Please do.
They both accepted that their job was to investigate what was happening and to record. And this was the theme of what they did. They spent all their time not judging each other, but checking whatever had happened. If one said this, the other one checked what had happened, and they discussed it between them. And this went on methodically throughout the investigation. And at the end, I think that their conclusions were pretty much similar. Firstly, they both said that, you know, anyone who says that they have an explanation for what is going on it's wishful thinking. There is no current explanation. And that is something one has to live with. I know that Guy, because of his activities in Brazil with mediums, did believe that mediumship was a strong methodology for interfering with the event. So on two or three occasions, he invited a medium along to try and ameliorate the situation and to calm it down, which arguably it did to a certain extent, but it always came back. So at the end of the day, whichever way they looked at it, whoever they spoke to, they were still up against the unknown.
If I could ask and kind of jump off track for a moment, the movie came out, The Conjuring 2, The Enfield Poltergeist. You know, the Enfield Haunting movie, again, really featured Guy and your father as the investigators in that case. When we spoke to Guy Playfair a number of years ago doing our show, I asked them about the involvement of the Warrens in that case. And he said he remembered them showing up for about a day. Ed Warren had taken him aside and said, you know what, this could be explosive. This could be big. We could make a lot of money working on this together. And with that, Guy Lyon Playfair kind of washed his hands of it and walked away and said, I have no use for this nor need for you to be here. And that was how he recalled the story. How do you recall it? How do you recall what occurred? And were the Warrens really a part of this investigation?
No, that's exactly right, Dave. My father told me that that the Warrens had come along, and they came and they went. I can't tell you why The Conjuring 2 happened. Maybe it was just they were looking for something that would make another film. But the actual film, The Conjuring 2, wasn't a bad representation in many ways. I was, you know, comfortable with the way that my father, for example, had been represented. But certainly they were minor players, and that's probably over-exaggerating their contribution.
I appreciate you coming up with that. Again, don't want to put anybody on the spot. I was just interested because they did still involve your father in the story for that.
Well, it'd be difficult to have the story without my father in it. It'd be like having the story without the Hodgsons.
Understandable. But again, the Warren's not being a major player in this case, you know, it's easy to see how liberties can definitely be taken in this situation.
Well, my father always told me that shortly after this happened, when Guy had written his book, it was sent off to Steven Spielberg, and shortly thereafter, the Poltergeist film arrived. Now, whether there was any connection or not, I don't know. I think it's actually accepted that there may have been a connection. But what this goes to is the fact that no one at the Enfield Poltergeist case was interested in making any money. This was all about a family in distress on the one side, and a pretty amazing opportunity to investigate and further the investigation of paranormal phenomenon. And this is what was being focused on. There was a balance between keeping the family safe and furthering the investigation. People always said, well, Mrs. Hodgson must have been doing this because she wanted to move house and get a better home. Nonsense, she loved her house, and it was the home for her children. And certainly no one connected, as far as I'm aware, made any money out of it. Quite the opposite. My father devoted 18 months of his life to it and did it for nothing other than the benefit of research, as did Guy.
I think it's an interesting point that this, again, was another world in terms of the fact that there wasn't really checkbook journalism in the way that it developed sort of from 30, 25 years ago. This was 40 years ago, and there really wasn't sort of checkbook journalism in the same way and at all, really. And there wasn't this. Now we have the sort of commoditization of what could be called productization, I don't know, but commoditization of ideas. So if you've got an idea, you sell it. And There's an awful lot of that about now, but it was entirely different then. Mrs. Hodgson actually loved her house, and she was thrilled to have. They were a very poor family; they didn't have much money, and she was thrilled to have a three-bedroom house, even though it had a downstairs bathroom. She was very pleased to have. It was a council house, which means public housing.
So most of the explanations for why they thought they were trying to cash in don't mesh up. We'll continue this. We have to take a break. Stay tuned. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Hello, and welcome to Coast AM. Richard Gross, Roz Morris, my guests this evening for the next 25 minutes, roughly. And we're talking about the Enfield Poltergeist case. I would be remiss if I didn't bring up the fact that there has been much said about the fact that the girls admitted at a few points that there were things that they faked regarding this case. At least that's what's been reported. Can either one of you lend any insight to this.
Yeah, if I could jump in there, Dave. In both my father's memoirs and in Guy's book, they refer to this, and the girls admitted that they did occasionally play a prank. What could it be? Perhaps 1% of what was going on was the result of their tricks. But my father was a father of three children, and he knew children well. And Guy and my father always caught them out whenever they played a trick. It was too easy to spot it, and so it never played a meaningful part in the investigation at all.
Roz, well, from your side, what did you want to say?
I was just going to say that there were actually sort of hundreds of incidents, and it always amuses me when some people sort of say, oh, well, the family did the fake the whole thing. They would have had to be incredibly clever and sort of world-class ventriloquists and just incredibly clever, cleverer than the greatest illusionists around now, to be able to fake everything. It just wouldn't be possible. Just on a simple factual basis, it wasn't possible. But I think one of the things that all this stuff does show is that there are people who keep an open mind about this. There are people who believe in the spirit world. And there are other people who, even if things happen in front of them, will say they didn't happen because they have a closed mind about it. And that was very revealing to me, that there are people with completely closed minds who just won't take any evidence on board at all.
If I could chip in there, Dave, you know, the Enfield poltergeist case is a record of facts, recorded poltergeist and telekinetic activity, levitation, telepathy, teleportation, it considered mediumship, super ESP, pretty much the full gamut of what we now call a paranormal, parapsychological activity. And my father considered all this, and then he said, you know, there are always going to be people out there who think that what happened was a result of lies, hoaxes, fraud, hallucinations, delusions, conjuring tricks, or even wishful thinking. And he always said, if you throw in paranoia for good measure, then you have the full toolbox, so beloved of the hardened skeptic. And I think that, seen in the round, that probably puts it all into perspective. Everything was there, everything was looked at, everything was recorded to the best of human ability at that stage in accordance with technology then available. It was written about in a calm and scientific fashion, and yet people still came along and came up with their excuses, but none of these excuses held water. None of the explanations held water either. And as a result, we're left with something which clearly happened, but really no one knows why.
And I think the, it's interesting that Guy Playfair used to say that nothing is supernatural. Everything is natural. We just don't know what causes it. And I think that's quite a good way of summing this up.
It is, right? I mean, it's something that is, you know, like many of the different things that back in the, you know, dark ages, they would have considered supernatural is just science now. Medicine, it's a perceived aspect of our regular daily lives. But there are these, by supernatural, I think it's just things that are above the normal that people look at. And here you've got a case that hits on so many things. And I guess Enfield poltergeist case sounds very limiting because, as you brought up earlier, Roz, poltergeist being kind of a knocking or a noisy ghost, that seems to kind of limit what the experiences were. But there was so much more to this because you had intelligent dialogue between something reportedly paranormal. You had knockings, apportations, you had teleportations. And was this right? She would be in one room and suddenly appear in another room?
Well, there was one wonderful instance where the family were in the house of the Nottinghams just down the road. And someone said that they saw my father at the window looking in. And then they went back to the house. And they said, well, you know, I said to my father, well, why were you outside, you know, the Nottinghams house looking in? He said, I wasn't. I've been here all the time. And there are people who witnesses of the fact that he had been there all the time. And this wasn't the only instance, for example, where, you know, people have been seen to be in two places at once, which is something well recorded in the history of the paranormal. I mean,
right,
this and
by location,
loads of other instances of strange things going on, you know, a pillow appearing on a roof, and how on earth did it get there? Things materializing in front of people's eyes. One could go on and on.
It sounds like at points the spirits were somewhat, or spirit was somewhat playful. I mean, in one of the recordings, your father asks, you know, are you just having a go at me? Or are you just having fun? And it kind of throws a pillow in his face.
Well, it vacillated from the playful to the downright dangerous. I mean, there was one instance where there was an iron grate fireplace in a room, and it ripped it out of the wall and bent some pipe work. Now, this thing weighed a ton, and it would have taken, you know, one strong-grown man to lift it, and yet it had been removed from the wall with no explanation. And it threw a metal pipe around the room. I mean, it could have killed someone. It got to a stage where it was highly dangerous, and it got to a stage with Janet where her trance-like states were very disturbing, and, you know, they went to doctors and to a hospital to make sure that her welfare was looked after. But these things came and they went, but the investigation continued, and the level-headedness of Guy and my father saw the whole thing through to what became a quiet conclusion.
I think it's important that Janet said she did feel herself to be in danger at times, and that she did feel very used and kind of as though things were pushing her around. And at one point she said that the curtains were wrapped around her neck, and that she was pushed downstairs. So it started off with stuff that was just disturbing, but, you know, but then it got worse. And so Janet was actually taken to the Maudsley Hospital, which is a psychiatric hospital, and she stayed there for a couple of months, and she was looked at by doctors, but they didn't find anything. They didn't find that she was mentally disturbed. It just gave her a rest from the whole thing. And I did go and visit her in the hospital with Guy Playfair, and she seemed fine there. And looking back on it now, Janet does say, as I've said, she does say she felt that she was used. There was something that happened that was extremely strange. And I must say that in my own experience, this is the weirdest story in a long career in journalism. This is the weirdest story I've ever reported on, and very disturbing.
Well, most poltergeist...
The interface between the phenomenon and the people in the house was also quite interesting. Mrs. Hodgson used to say that she got headaches, you know, before things happened, Margaret and Janet also complained about that type of thing. There was a strange dynamic going on in that house that was at times very disturbing, but fortunately no one was hurt.
But also, I think it's important to point out, and I know you'll agree with this, Richard, that there weren't any demons or devils or crosses turned upside down and all the sort of Hollywood stuff. You've
Absolutely.
Talked, Dave, about Hollywoodization. And I think it's important to say that the Enfield Poltergeist was extremely strange without any of the Hollywood additions.
Was your father ever concerned for your well-being or your family's, being around this, kind of saturating his life with this and knowing that this phenomena had an ability to move and not always just be in one place?
No, he wasn't concerned, because it showed, and there was no evidence that it was jumping, as it were, via him to somewhere else. The epicenter was Janet, and everything happened in Enfield. And that was very comforting for him. It was a devotion for him of time, but it never affected his family life.
Roz, you mentioned that, you know, she went to the hospital and for a few months and was under care. Did activity ever occur around her in the hospital? And what was the activity level at the house when she was removed?
Well, it did seem to calm down when she wasn't there. I mean, Janet did seem to be the focus of the activity. And of course, one of the things we haven't mentioned is that poltergeist activity, as reported over the centuries, usually takes place when there's a young person in the house, usually female, but can be a young boy, approaching the age of puberty. And Janet was at exactly that stage in her life. So a lot of people have thought that Janet was the key person to the whole thing. She did say she sort of looked around when she was at the Maudsley and sort of wondered if anything was happening, but she didn't really think anything much was happening. And it's interesting, when Margaret was interviewed many years later for a TV documentary, she said, I get jumpy sometimes and I look around and I can't tell people why, and that's because of the poltergeist. So I think it's made a lasting impression on both of them.
One of the key points of discussion between my father and Guy was the impact of stress on phenomena. I know that my father, throughout his 28 years of investigation, always started an investigation by finding out if there was any element of stress in the house or wherever it might have been. And always, after probing, he found, you know, one situation or another that was very, very stressful. There was a great deal of stress within the Enfield community. Mrs. Hodgson had broken up with her husband. The children were obviously affected. There was, you know, they were economically challenged. It was a very difficult environment. And my father believed that possibly opened the way for, you know, energy flows. Certainly that was something that Guy also believed in, energy flows. But you can't go beyond generalization about this, because no one knows the answer. So you can only try and, over time, see what's common to the circumstance, say that happened here but didn't happen there, but that thing actually happened pretty well everywhere. Perhaps that has some practical meaning. But we're not talking at the level of the scientist, we're talking at the level of the investigator and observation.
It's interesting, too, because most poltergeist cases are very short-lived. In most cases, you know, maybe a couple weeks up to a month. But this stretched out over a two-year period. What was the final findings of the Society for Cyclical Research? Did they ever give any credence? I mean, this seems like the holy grail of cases for this investigative group.
As far as I'm aware, the general consensus was things had happened. There was a full record of what had gone on, and it goes into the SPRI archive along with so many other things. As Mark, probably another instance of paranormal activity unexplained.
Well, the case was reinvestigated by the SPR in 1981 or 82 by a special committee and the Enfield Poltergeist Investigation Committee, which is EPIC, E-P-I-C. But anyway, it re-examined some of the witnesses and collected evidence and issued a nearly 200-page report concluding that paranormal incidents had taken place at the house. So they did, after some initial skepticism from some members of the Society for Psychical Research, other than Guy and Morris, they did actually do an official report on it.
I know we have very few moments left together, but this went on for a few years. Did it ever come to an end? And I know the mom ended up passing away in that house as of 2003, correct?
Yes, Mrs. Hodgson died in the house. And I mean, interestingly, one of the Daily Mirror reporters right at the start asked her if she wanted to move and was that why she was saying these things. And she said, no, she didn't. And that was never the case. She was so relieved to have a proper house of her own, having come from very poor circumstances. And she died in the house in 2003. So that gives the lie to anything that says, and I think it's very unfair to Mrs. Hodgson, who I always found was a very sincere woman, struggling in difficult circumstances. And it's very unfair to say that she did this for any reasons at all. She just struggled to put up with it.
And they never, I mean, I know the Amityville family was supposedly paid millions of dollars, which I know Christopher Lutz, the youngest boy, that was never the case. Did the family ever cash in on this story?
No.
See, that's what I think is one of the most fascinating aspects for all of the naysayers and the people who can, you know, armchair quarterback 20, 30, 40 years later and review a few books and point out all the flaws and the investigative techniques and this and that, but they never put boots on the ground to actually investigate this. And their claims that people were trying to cash in when nothing ever exchanged, they never got out of the house, that to me is strange. Is this case over? Did it finally come to a complete stop?
It kind of fizzled out, I think, Dave. You know, things less and less started to happen, and life moved on for the family, thank God. You know, the girls grew older, and they started to embark upon their own lives. And today, they, you know, both have families, and thank God for that.
Well, I can't thank you both enough. I mean, it's a fascinating look into a case that I don't think should ever be forgotten, because it is one of the most impressive collections, like you said, over thousands of different activities that took place in front of witnesses. It's amazing, and obviously it's made an impact on both of your lives.
It has indeed. Thank you very much, Dave.
Thank you very much, Roz. And Richard, thank you very much for sharing your father's story with us. And we would love to hear from you, the listeners, as well. What are your thoughts on shows like this? When you hear this and the preponderance of evidence that was collected, that you hear the voices for yourself, email me, dave@darknessradio.com. And if you've had experiences like this that you believe, you know, were truly part of the supernatural, I'd love to hear your stories as well. Or if you're currently going through a situation with the paranormal like that, email me, dave@darknessradio.com. We've got two more hours of show coming up, and we're going to be talking with Philip Smith. His book, Walking Through Walls, a memoir, talks about his father's life and what a strange life it was, this psychic healer who miraculously cured thousands of people. Can this be real? What is it like to be in the presence of somebody with these type of abilities? We'll find out that and so much more as we continue our journey into the strange and supernatural this evening. George Norrie is off. I am here with you for the remainder of the show. I'm Dave Schrader. Check out my site at darknessradio.com. We'll be back with more of the best in overnight talk radio. This is Coast to Coast AM.